Blog Talk Radio.
We've got film. And we've got psychology. When we put the two together, we've got filmcology. Each week, we will look at the psychology of the characters in film, and it gives us something lovely to think about. So, let's get started. Filmcology is now.
Hello, everybody, and today is a huge day in American history. It is actually the anniversary of Medgar Evers' death. He was born July 2nd, 1925, and he died June 12th, 1963, after he was murdered by a very lost soul. I'm going to give you some history about Medgar Evers, and then we'll talk about the movie. I've got a couple of articles here. One of the things, if you... Oh, no. Hopefully that was just like a delivery, so it's not really something to worry about. But anyways, sorry about that, folks. But I'm in my living room. So anyways, in the headlines, they're talking about seven things that you should know about Medgar Evers. Shortly after midnight on June 12, 1963, NAACP field secretary and civil rights leader Medgar Evers was gunned down in the driveway of his Jackson, Mississippi home. He was only 37 years old. His murder came just hours after President John F. Kennedy's famed civil rights address shocked the nation and has inspired dozens of songs, poems, books, and films in the 50 years since, well, 51 years. So here are some things that you may not know or might like to know. What's interesting is Medgar Evers fought for this country in World War II, participated in the Normandy invasion. He was the third of five children born to a farmer and sawmill worker, James Evers, and his wife, Jessie. He left high school at the age of 17 to enlist in the still segregated U.S. Army, eventually rising to the rank of sergeant. And then in 1944, his unit was part of the massive post-D-Day invasion of Europe. He served both in France and Germany until his honorable discharge in 1946. Due to his wartime service, he was buried in the Arlington National Cemetery with full military honors following his death, and that happened in 1963. He was the first field secretary in the South for NAACP. If you don't know what NAACP stands for, it's the National Association of Colored People. It's a huge organization that has gone through its own transitions and demons over the years. So he did go to college. He attended Alcorn, which is now Alcorn State University. Back then it was Alcorn College, on his GI Bill. He earned honors as one of the most successful students in the nation. The nation. After moving to nearby Mound Bayou, Evers worked as an insurance agent and began attending meetings of a local civil rights organization, the Regional Council of Negro Leadership, RCNL. The same year, the landmark Supreme Court decision, Brown versus Board of Education, struck down racial segregation in Mississippi law school. When Evers' his application was denied on a technicality, the school claimed that he failed to include the required letters of recommendation. Evers approached the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People for help. NAACP Mississippi State Conference leader E.J. Stringer was really taken by Evers' poise, his determination, that he offered him a position as a field secretary in the South. He accepted, and that's when they opened the office in Jackson. Within 3 years, he had nearly doubled the NAACP membership in Mississippi to more than 15,000 people. So one of his assignments was, first assignments was investigating the murder of somebody named Emmett Till. In August of 1955, Till, who was only 14 years old, was visiting relatives in Money, Mississippi. He was kidnapped by a group of white men after reportedly flirting with the wife of a local shopkeeper. Unfortunately, they used that sort of excuse to lynch black men all throughout the South. The likelihood of most of those type of things happening were just not realistic. If people are being murdered left and right for doing something, generally you don't do it. And most likely this 14-year-old just happened to look that direction, if he even saw the woman. So anyways, after he was kidnapped, 3 days later they found his beaten and disfigured body in a nearby river. He had been shot in the head, weighed down with a metal fan in an attempt to hide his body. So, Till's family's insistence, an open casket funeral for her son took place, which I guess it would be horrific, but I know that there's a real strong sentiment for a lot of people, like, look what they did to my son, or look what they did to my loved one. You need to see what you all did or you allowed people to do. So they were scared of the sheriff, who was he had a real segregated sheriff's office. He didn't mount any effort to catch the murders. So the NAACP decided to launch their own investigation. And so they were able to track down different witnesses that actually were able to give information about the abduction of this young man, so 14 years old. And people actually were convinced to come forward. They were kept in protective custody. There was a trial of two men that were accused of killing the young man. They were immediately shepherded out of town. Secretly, when the all-white jury returned a verdict of not guilty after deliberating just 1 hour. So it's like he's been involved. My point about his life, and I'll read some more, is Medgar Evers led this life of extreme service in the face of absolute danger. Many of us volunteer work. We do volunteer work. Maybe we work for Rape Relief, or we work for Red Cross, or wherever you're volunteering, you help out at a dog shelter. But most of us don't do that at the threat of our lives or the threat of our family's lives. And this man did. He had threats on him for what he did, basically his whole adult life. Anyways, he helped to integrate Ole Miss, which, a really, really, really long time, huge university in the South. University of Mississippi finally had to desegregate their law school with James Meredith. This is the one that we talked about. I can't remember when we talked about this, or maybe it was something that I talked about for this episode. They actually said they were going to no longer segregate, But they went as far as to make him sit, James Meredith, sit out in the hallway while the rest of the class, all white people, sat in the classroom. Because back then, a white person shouldn't have to be besotted by a black person while they're trying to learn law. Okay, so anyway, the segregation took place. It required response by John F. Kennedy, our president, and something like 30,000 National Guardsmen. And it was just, it really was a mess. Two people ended up dead from that whole situation. Okay, so then we know that Evers was shot just after President Kennedy delivered his speech on civil rights. It took 31 years for the man who assassinated Medgar Evers to be brought to justice because of the just kangaroo court that they had in place back in Mississippi at that time. At this point in time, Medgar Evers' widow, she has remarried, and she has gone on to continue to serve in the NAACP. And that she was elected as the chairperson shortly after Byron D. LeBeckwith was convicted. Byron D. LeBeckwith is the one who murdered Medgar Evers. So, let's get to the movie, shall we? There is so much to say about this incredible young man and how he fought for, he fought against discrimination. He didn't just fight for against discrimination against black people. He, like Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and many of the civil rights workers, were looking for equal treatment across the board for all Americans. So they gave their lives. So anyways, here's a little bit more from the biography, and then we're going to get to this. I'm going to kind of go back and forth between this movie and this man's life. His high profile as the South's field agent for the NAACP is one of the reasons that people in Mississippi were pretty nasty towards him, because, of course, he could affect change. Now, in June of back in those times, in the 1960s, the early 1960s, there were all manner of issues that happened regarding African or blacks in the South. And say blacks, that's what they, when they were nice, they called people of African American descent in the 1960s, which was a hotbed of civil rights unrest for minorities, especially African American descent or black people. So, for instance, on the 21st, just the opposite of the 12th, but the 21st, as in next week, it'll be the anniversary of these three young men who died, who were trying to help black people garner or register to vote. And they were simply just trying to help people access their rights. Simply, that's all it was. And I guess Mississippi is just one of those states that has taken a while or has taken quite some time to wake up to this situation. It's just horrific. But the three students were James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner. They actually lynched the young black, there's the young black man, James Cheney, they actually lynched him and murdered the other two. There was a group in Mississippi called the Mississippi White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. And they were saying, historically, they were much more disgusting or hateful than just the plain Klan. So they actually had planned to intercede or interfere with these young men when they knew they were coming back down. They just to kind of get them to even draw them out, let me say, draw them out to this one particular town where they had planned, they had basically planned to lie in wait for them. They burned down a church. All the people escaped the church, but the people that these young men had actually gotten to register to vote, they literally had beaten those church members in the congregation and the other people, black people of that area, to prevent them from going ahead with voting during the time that voting would take place. So these three men came back out to find out what happened to the congregation and the people that they had already gotten registered to vote. They knew that there would probably be trouble, and they were trying to get through this town as quickly as possible, and they took a shortcut. Unfortunately, they ended up with tire trouble, which I believe they've proven that the tire trouble was planned. And then the young black man was the one who was driving, so immediately the sheriff claimed he was driving 35 miles over the speed limit, which clearly, I mean, they weren't going to do anything like that. And then they took him to jail. They separated the three men, and that's when they brutally beat the young black man terribly beyond recognition, and they ended up lynching him. And then they killed the other two men. And so that set everything into it stepped up the civil rights unrest problems in the South. And the lynch mob was led by the sheriff that arrested the young man. So I will say this at the outset with psychology, and we actually see this today, all these years later, with issues that take place in America with black people and with in relation to white people, especially how they feel and how things may be in the South. There are a lot of northern black people who will not travel in the South because they still are terrified that they're going to run into some little weird pocket of the Klan that might do something. When my brother was living in Killeen, Texas, and that was so back in the early 80s, it was just actually a little bit before I graduated from high school. Somebody had burned a cross in one of his neighbor's yards one street over. My mom kept wanting to send me down south to attend college because she felt that I didn't have a healthy understanding of how things were in the South. I don't really need for someone to burn my hand to understand that it's going to harm me. And I have to admit, I was terrified of actually being sent to the South for college. And luckily, I was able to take charge of my, or maybe not luckily, I don't know. Southern schools that are typically more black ratioed actually tend to produce much higher caliber of students. So I guess I sort of, you know, I dodged a bullet, but maybe I shot off my own foot. I don't know. probably would have graduated many years ago. But anyways, so we're not talking about something that has completely disappeared from this country. So when we watch a movie like The Ghosts of Mississippi, and we read about how everything took place, Medgar Evers' family were home the night that he was shot in his driveway. They were home watching TV, and they were home watching the actual speech by John F. Kennedy. And when they heard the shots, and then they ran out and had to retrieve, you know, their dying father and husband, his children. Imagine that horrific thought. So what I'm trying to say from the psychological perspective, there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of disconnect that continues to go on in America today. For instance, I was talking to my brother earlier today, and it would pain me, except that I have a different perspective in life. My brother was saying that when he had got on the bus, and he said he made this comment as he was on his way to work, and he said, "Still, I just cannot believe that still it's like people act like they're afraid to sit next to me." My brother is a very handsome man. He's much darker than I am, and I don't, not that that means anything to me or anything, but it apparently means a lot to a lot of people. He's a darker black man, so for some reason, the shading level makes a difference on whether you're safer or not safer around somebody who's black. And what I was hearing, and I wanted to stop at that moment as he was talking, is almost like somehow he was going to feel some sort of shame, as if it was his problem. And I said, you know, here's the thing. Somebody who's afraid to sit you next to you doesn't understand how incredible you are. And the reality is, you know, if they even knew even 1 ounce of who you were and your character, who you are, then they'd be clamoring to get in your lap. I said, so, or in your presence. I said, so here's the thing, David, just when people kind of act like that, you just forget even before they act like that. Every time you step on a bus, every time you go anywhere, you need to live in that mindset that everybody wants to be sitting next to me, because I am a college graduate. You know, I've got a degree in business. You know, I mentor young people. I'm out there doing great things for a lot of people. And I do it because that's in my heart. That's the way I was raised. Yeah, we come from a Southern family. And so he's an incredible, I tell him all the time, he's a man among men. But my brother David has me. So I'm counteracting that psychological trauma that continues today. And one of the things that you see when you watch movies like Ghosts of Mississippi and you start thinking about what happened back then and what goes on now, you can see a direct result in the way that a lot of young African-American males or people, how they feel sort of either bitter or rebellious, because they really don't feel secure that their country and the people that they live with in this country accept them or don't somehow mean them harm. My first lover, my first boyfriend, he was Caucasian, and he dated a young, beautiful black woman in the South many years before he met me. And they were getting harassed all the time because of their interracial relationship. And then one night, I guess they were at her place, and he said they were in bed sleeping, and somebody busted in the front door, and they set across a fire in her front yard. And he said that he just wanted to go out there, and he was going to take care of anybody who would do this kind of terrorizing. Of course, you know, they all run. And she basically told him that was it. She didn't want to date him anymore because she was too terrified. And she, while she adored him, she just couldn't handle it. It just, she was scared. Now, I don't know what color you are, whoever you are, if you're listening to this, but, you know, forget whether, if you could just take a second outside of if you have any prejudices, left or right, just consider yourself as if anybody in the world would not like who you are for something that you have nothing to do with. Whether they think that your nose is too big or they think that your earlobes are too odd, you know, whereas everybody else believes that there's something wrong with you because your earlobes are either hang too low or you don't have earlobes at all. Just try to imagine what it would be like where somebody actually hated you and you've never met them. You've had no interaction with them. It is purely based on just something about the way you look, that your hair isn't right or you're not wearing the right clothes. You know, well, sure, we may not necessarily like what somebody's wearing or we may not particularly care for their hairstyle, but actual hatred. Now, let's understand what hatred means. In a psychological sense, it means you wish that person dead. It's not like a little glib term where you say, oh, I hate that guy. He's such a clod. No. Oh, I hate it when people, put milk in their mashed potatoes. We're not talking about that. We're not talking about just some glib little thing. We're talking hatred, as in they wish you dead, and they're thinking about ways to make you dead. So that's the environment that these people were living in. And to talk about somebody who has this soul of service with this absolute love in their heart for all people, that he's willing to sacrifice everything that he loves, his children, his wife, his family. He's willing to sacrifice that to help this country be better. I can think of a story in the Bible, Abraham and Isaac, where God asked a man to sacrifice his son. And that wasn't even from hatred. So somebody's willing to sacrifice because of the love and the hope for the future. Abraham was going to sacrifice his son for the love of God. And this man, who's not in the Bible, but could be, Megar Evers was willing to sacrifice his family. And he did. He gave up everything for civil rights. Now, in the movie, and this is a true story, this attorney, he is married to a woman whose family is extremely racist. He has two children. His wife is a Southern belle of the sort of daughters of the South of the Confederacy type sentiment. Everything that her husband did in her mind is either going to help or hurt his career or potentially embarrass her and her family. She is upset the whole time because he would actually consider representing this woman whose husband was murdered some 25 years earlier. And she, this woman who was Megareva's wife, she kept trying to get justice for her husband, because when the initial trial took place in 1963, about a year after Megareva's murder, even, they show it in the movie, even the governor of the state came through and shook the hand of the murderer in court in full view of everybody. Everybody. So you have to think to yourself what that's saying to the judge sitting at that court, the judge who is elected to that court, that anything you do, it better be in keeping with whatever the governor is in line with, in alignment with. And the government, I mean the governor, excuse me, is obviously in alignment with the murderer. The jury had 12 white men as jurors, and of course they're not going to do anything that would hurt the guy sitting at the table who's a white man, when you're basically representing the murder of a black man. And so there was a not guilty verdict, and the whole situation, which was not even a correct trial, it was either a hung jury or they just, I don't even think it was a hung jury, I think they just found it not guilty. He was just acquitted. It was just some crazy response that it would embarrass anybody who understands anything about law. But everybody knew that that was something not to touch. So 25 years later, when even again, Megareva's wife was pleading for some assistance and nobody was going to take it. And then finally, the character played by Alec Baldwin, he looked over the files and thought that this is a case that should be tried. He didn't look at it from the point of view of this is the most winnable case. He thought about it from the point of view of himself being about the same age and having two little children. And what if somebody had done something like that to him? Now, from a psychological point of view, that's usually when you can get somebody to sort of break down their walls of hatred, is when you can somehow get them to understand that they're no different than the person they hate. And that's a real uncomfortable thing to get to. Let's put it in terms of something pretty easy. That's, you know, easy to digest, not something that's racial. Now, if you don't like bugs, or you hate cockroaches, or you hate spiders, like, and you can, most people I know that aren't entomologically, you know, correct, politically correct, they don't like spiders. They hate them. And you know how we know? They kill them. They kill them as soon as they see them. If you have a cockroach in your house, most likely you're going to try to kill that, or you're trying to move something. You know, and these are the same responses that happened back then in the South. A black person moved into the town, they either need to be dead or they need to be gone. And that whole phrase, there goes the neighborhood, yeah, it sounds like a joke, and now we've pretty much relegated it to comedy shows, but it was very real. And it was very real even when I was a little girl living in the South. There were certain neighborhoods in the Seattle area that black people were not allowed to live in. And we have proof of it, where they literally had it written in the deeds that would not allow anyone who had any African descent to move into that neighborhood. So when people started to raise legal issues against that, then the people who lived in that neighborhood literally pulled their money and purchase the house themselves, thereby preventing, they basically locked out any minorities from moving into those neighborhoods. My oldest brother actually used to deliver newspapers to one of those neighborhoods, and you were allowed to go there between the hours of whatever and whatever to deliver newspapers. If you were there like 15 minutes later than that, the police were called, and you could get roughed up. Yeah. So, now, we're back in the South. The woman who plays Megger Evers' wife is Whoopi Goldberg. And whatever you think of her comedy or whatever her show, The View, whatever, I don't watch. But it has nothing to do, just I don't have time to watch everything. I'm a graduate student. So, but she played her part brilliantly. As a matter of fact, all the characters in this movie played their parts brilliantly, which includes James Woods, who played Byron D. Beckwith, just nasty, pustulant, blight on society, lost soul. Lost soul is all I can really, truly say that gives it justice. And it takes being lost to do such hateful things to another human being for such ridiculous, hateful reasons. But they all played their part so well that as you're watching it, your heart broke for Whoopi Goldberg. You were terrified for Alec Baldwin, who was now fighting this for the recognition of this murderer and the justice to take place. And then James Woods, who after the show, you can't help but wanting to go slap James Woods. You just thought the worst things about that character. And yet James Woods is not that person. He's that brilliant of an actor that he could play someone that you can't even, they did his makeup so well that you can actually compare real life photographs of DeBeckwith with James Woods and they look like each other, like it's the same person, just, and it, horrifically. I looked at the real DeBeckwith and I kept thinking he had makeup on him. He had to have makeup or something. Because I knew that's what was on James Woods' face, and it wasn't. It's a real mind game, and you have to step back and remember this is the movie. This is not the real life. It's based on real life story, but the psychology of all that that's taking place, the racism and living through that. I mean, in the movie, the actual attorney that worked the case for Megger Evers' widow, his house was bombed. Somebody contacted him to tell him that if he had his children at home, he needed to get them out of the house right away. And so he got his children, and at the time, I believe he was remarried or he was dating someone. They left the house, and then they literally bombed part of his house. So now we have another person who's fighting for justice and, nearly sacrificing his family as well. And all of this is because, what, somebody doesn't like the color of your skin? Somebody's afraid that somehow you might be better than they are? Anyways, as we go through the movie, there were twists and turns where there were legal precedents that could possibly be set and then nobody wanted to do that. The attorney, his wife basically left him. They were trying to find evidence, but trying to find evidence for a crime that everybody refused to acknowledge pretty much meant that they'd already decimated any of the evidence, or it was hidden. And there was a great break in the case when the Alec Baldwin character, the attorney, remembered that his wife's racist father and his father-in-law, they were attorneys and had served in some capacity on that particular trial, that there was an old gun. There was an old rifle that this guy had. And he actually remembered the rifle. He went and he absconded the rifle, and they were able to match up the evidence to that rifle that was taken away and hidden to prevent Beckwith from being, you know, tried as guilty. It was sort of like a weird clue that if they had gotten rid of it, there's no way the justice would have been found. But in the long run, it actually served in the favor of the family, and they finally got justice. They finally got justice all those years later. 31 years. You know, all of Medgar Evers' children, by now, they were probably in their 40s. You know, they're adults, have their own families, and there's grandchildren. All that in this world that Medgar Evers is trying to help make fair. In a country that this man loved this country, he served in this country, even in a segregated army. He fought in a country that treated him like dirt, but he fought for that country. And they continued to treat him like dirt when he was murdered, and then his murderer was allowed to go free for 31 years. Yeah, it's heart-wrenching. Now, on the other side of the coin, from the perspective of somebody who is not the minority that is quote-unquote hated, there's all the issues that come into play with standing up and doing the right thing. Now, from a psychological perspective, you have to either have no understanding of the consequences, or all you've ever been taught is to stand up and do the right thing. Let's take a look at your lives when it's something to do with work. If you do something at work and nobody knows about it, are you going to tell somebody? Are you just going to let it slide until somebody says, hey, who wrecked the car, the company car? There's a big gash on it. If it was you who did it, are you going to come forward and say, I wrecked the company car first? Or are you going to just sort of wait until somebody tries to indicate it's you and then you try to deny it, you know, and hope to God you get away with it? Now, these are ethical issues and ethical standards, which are really, really strong in psychology. We have guidelines, principles and guidelines that we're to follow as psychologists. The American Psychological Association has really strict guidelines about what's considered ethical they cover everything, how we get our payments or demand payment or when payment's done, how you treat a person, you know, who has a right to the information and the confidentiality and the right to health care. There's all kinds of things. It's to help keep psychologists in both protected for themselves by not stepping off the path, and then also to protect the clients. And that takes ethics. When I was working as a driver for the bus company, I was driving a route. It was a route that was, there's a street that a curve that came into a main thoroughfare that was about a four lane road. And when they're really tight streets, the problem comes in when there's delivery drivers during the day, and a lot of them don't pull their trucks all the way off the road because a lot of times they can't get off the road with little boutiques and little shops where there's a lot of parking on the street. So my bus came along, and I was creeping, and we have a right side mirror for the bus I was driving that actually, what they have, it's called a breakaway mirror. It'll actually break off, or it'll sort of, there's an arm that sort of bends in so that it doesn't just smash off to or break something. Well, as I was creeping along, because when you're going fast, then you'll have an accident. When you're going by something so tight, it's always best to go really slow because that way you can stop, or if something, you can get somebody to move out of the way. Well, there was a guy there with a delivery truck, and I was going by his delivery truck, his driver's side with mirror. Well, my mirror came up to it and sort of tapped it, but to this day, I'm pretty sure that I didn't break his mirror, but as I went past his mirror, I just was really watching it, and I was just trying to be careful, and I had a lot of people on my bus. They were right there alongside with where the mirror was, and they could see as well, and they could hear. But as I went past, I did notice on the ground that there was some glass. And so I stopped my bus, and I got out to go check his mirror, and his mirror was shattered. Well, the likelihood is somebody else came by there and shattered it. But because in my sense of ethics, the right thing to do would be to at least alert this guy, and I just want to make sure that there was no fault on my part, and if he had confirmed that it had already been hit. But his whole response at first was like, oh, don't worry about it. You know, we lose our mirrors all the time. His car was double parked. It was illegal. But I could have waited and gone into the second lane. But I knew that my mirror was going to swing back. Okay, so long story short, what I'm saying is I made sure that this man had my information for my bus company. You take it, and, you know, if there's a problem. And he's like, don't worry about it. It's like, trust me, they're not, you know, this happens all the time. But he gave the information. I gave him the information. Technically, we're not supposed to leave the scene of anything like that without training information. I figured, well, this guy is probably right because I pretty much had a feeling someone else got that mirror. But just to be safe, I got home. I reported it. I mean, back home, back to the bus barn. As you go into the bus barn, there's what they call a hopper, and that person you are checking in is where to park your bus, and you tell them, there's a dent on this side, somebody hit me here, or there's a problem with the steering wheel, whatever, so that they know to get the bus fixed back up for the next day's, you know, work. And next thing I know, probably like a week later, I got called in because I supposedly had an accident. And it's like, when did I have an accident? So this guy, you know, says one thing out in the road that, you know, was probably someone else, and he thought that the mirror already had a crack. Well, he put in the information. So that went against me as a driver. And now I'm just, you know, yeah, I took the fall. It's okay, because I have those kind of ethical standards. But here's the thing, and I'm asking you this, who you are, not because you need to tell me, but so that you can ask yourself and, you know, look in the mirror and who are you to yourself. There were other drivers when they found out what happened. I think I might have gotten a couple day suspension or something. One of the drivers said, why did you tell anybody? And this driver was, you know, she went to church every Sunday. She was a quote-unquote good Christian, and she was always spewing stuff about the Lord. And she said, nobody was even going to know. And I said, I knew. And she goes, well, that just doesn't even make any sense. Another driver said to me, he said, I've been here 17 years, and they don't have one accident on me. And I said, have you ever had an accident? He goes, yeah, but they don't have anything on me. He said, every time that they say that something, I don't ever tell them. I don't ever write it up. And if they ask me, then if there is an accident, I'd say, I don't know anything about it. And if they try to say I did it, I'd say, prove it. Okay. Yeah. So here's my point. Ethics, everybody has them. How well your ethics are stacked, if they're really high or if they're next to nil, that's something that you're going to have to live with spiritually no matter what. It doesn't matter if anyone else knows or not. The guy that told me that he would, you know, he's never going to take responsibility of it, that says something about his character. And the good Christian who's telling me I should have never told anybody, I don't know what that means. When people say stuff like that to me, I've had friends tell me not to tell my sweetie that I, you know, some guy went out with a guy or this, or somebody approached me. Why would you ever tell? It's like, why wouldn't I? Why wouldn't I? But that's the kind of weird ethical person I am. Another reason I'm probably in psychology. I don't know, but we all need to take a good look at how having low to no ethics, ethical principles, leads to this kind of hatred. And it helps it helps perpetuate it. So imagine what it would be like in the world we live in today if everybody took responsibility for their actions. If you feel that you're right in killing somebody because you think that they're so horrible and evil and they're of whatever, they're inconsequential, the fact that you would hide it already tells me you know something's wrong with that action. And that means you're really weak, whoever you are. And your low ethical or non-responsibility for your actions is the reason you live in a world that you think you're going to be fearful of. The only person that Beckwith really had to fear in life was not some man who's willing to fight for this country and willing to lose his life for his family. It's people like himself. Somebody who has no moral compass, somebody who has apparently no idea of what personal responsibility is, and somebody who doesn't understand what the word ethics is or how to spell it. Because if he were to live in a world with 100,000 like him, he could be gone tomorrow because somebody thought his tie just didn't look right. Or just the way that his glasses sit on his face was enough to terrify them to just murder him, because nobody wants people with those kind of glasses in their neighborhood. Or because people like him might support some particular idea that they don't support. We all have to take a good look at our history and how our history can inform the future that we're living in. Ask yourself, is that the kind of child you want to raise? Ask yourself if that's the kind of man you want to be. Or are you a patriot, somebody who actually would go and potentially give your life for your country, who would go and potentially give your life for your family? I'm going to read to you something that Megar Evers said, and I think that basically says it all about how he believed, what he believed about who he was and about this country. He said, "Freedom has never been free. I love my children and I love my wife with all my heart. I would die gladly, if that would make a better life for them." He said that just 5 days before he died, 51 years ago. So anyway, if you get a chance, I know I didn't talk about the movie Total Intricacies, but this movie really is about racial injustice, ethical responsibility, personal responsibility, and, you know, obliterating hatred and understanding just who the people are that we may or may not understand and what they've done for their country. Can a person be all that bad that is willing to give their life for your country so that the Beckwiths were able to get away with what they were able to get away with 51 years ago? Interesting. So anyway, that's it for our show. We'll go ahead and talk about some of these episodes that are coming up. Tomorrow there's going to be Friday traffic jams at 5 p.m., and that's with Lennis. You got an hour, and she's going to do classic rock. On Saturday, it's Time to Love with Lydia Pello. She's going to be doing Nurture with Nature. And her show is at 2 p.m. Pacific time. On Sunday, there'll be psychic readings by Lennis at 3 p.m. Pacific time. And she's got a special going this month where if you call in and you're the ninth caller, then you can get a free hour, 60-minute reading. And that's worth $60, and you'll be in competition with everyone else. Call it in. Uh-oh, it's the chime for BBC.
On the deck with tea.
At first I thought I would not allow that to be on the shows, ladies and gentlemen, but it has to do with my manifesting a real important part of my life in the next couple months, so you can share in it when it happens, and I'll be talking to you about it. But for now, every once in a while, you might hear that chime. Okay. And then the next show will be at 7 p.m., and that is LNB's Passage to Empowerment. And that show is Women Unleashing Your Power, Part 1. We talked about last week how people have given their power away and how to avoid giving their power away and how to recognize when you've given your power away. So we're going to have a three-part series where we're going to talk about women and their power. The next show will be men and their power. And then the final show will be about how those powers come together and sort of interesting, intimate, and possibly not intimate ways. So that'll be LNB at 7 p.m. is the new time frame starting out next week. It'll be 7 p.m. Pacific time. And then the next show on Tuesday at 6 p.m. will be BYO Brilliance, one of my other shows, The Brilliance of Belonging. Now, yeah, and I guess Beckwith, he would belong to the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, Old Mississippi. So I guess that's what helped make him feel like he was okay. Hopefully you can choose a different organization, like one to do with your college or some sports, intramural sports you're involved with, maybe your high school, your college, or your job, something. There's all kinds of ways to belong. Maybe you join the Sierra Club or Mountaineers. There's just all kinds of ways. We'll be talking about that on Tuesday at 6 p.m. Then on Wednesday at 7 p.m. in the studio with Lennis, she usually covers hot topics of the week or what's going on or something to do with entertainment, sports, whatever's out there in the regime that I'm usually too obtuse to be involved with. But her show comes on at 7 p.m. And then that brings us back to next Thursday. Next Thursday on the 19th, we'll be reviewing the movie The Professional, or the European name was Leon, the Professional, or Leon, however you want to say it. And it's about a man, a hitman, who ends up with this little orphan who sort of burrows into his heart, you know, unintentionally, both on both parts, and it's just, it gives us some psychological things to consider about family. Who's family? What's family? Love, you know, what kind of relationships can love come from? And there's a lot of untraditional love relationships out there, and so it'd be really a good movie to discuss. Also has an element of comedy, or lighten things up a little, but it also has a level of violence. Human beings are just, there seems to be violence somewhere, but guess what? There always seems to be love there too. So tune in next week, 6 p.m. for The Professional. I hope you get a chance to check it out. It's really a cute movie with Jean Reno, and Natalie Portman is her first feature film, little tiny Natalie, and how she just totally, yeah, she gets
Brenda?
Renee Russo. Yeah. Yes.
Brenda, I'd just like to say something before we go off the air. I'd like to thank you for doing this movie today and bringing to light all the travesties that have happened, and I think in some cases are still happening, and to make everybody aware that, you know, we're all the same. We're all brothers and sisters. We should all be united in this world. There should be no prejudice. And hopefully you've riled some people up enough and made them think enough that they'll stop and think before they'll do something. And I couldn't be on earlier because I was so close to tears, and I still am. This just shouldn't be happening. And but I do thank you. It's it was a good movie.
Yeah. So, well, thank you. I'm, you know, sorry that you felt the tears. It's a sad thing, but we're learning from it, so we'll keep moving forward.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know what? Sometimes you have to shed a few tears.
Sometimes you do.
You do. And it's a good thing. It really is. It makes people stop and think, and hopefully make a difference. Make a difference, people. All that matters is love and being kind to the rest of the universe.
Right.
Thank you, Brenda.
Thank you, sweetie. And thank you, all of you who are listening on the archives, and you hope that you don't hold anything against me, whatever it is I've said. I have no hatred or negative thoughts towards people on this. Ole Miss, you know, a great institution out there, and I know a lot of great people have gone there. And Mississippi, I know there's a lot of great people in Mississippi, and I know that they don't all think with hatred. So, yeah. And anyone that's associated with Beckwith, you know, I just, you know, pray for you and your families, and along with Medgar Evers and all of his families, that, you know, we can all heal from the wounds of misunderstandings and really, really, really see people completely for their spirit, because our spirits are so much better than the things we think and see in our meat suits. So take care, everybody, and we'll see you next week. Bye. Thank you, everyone who was in that room as well. Okay. Good night.